Are you an insider? Subscribe to FC Insiders today to receive full unedited interviews, news, rumors, exclusive content, and more. Join FC Insiders at futurecommerce.fm. Future Commerce is brought to you by DotMailer. DotMailer is faster, smarter, and better email marketing automation. DotMailer is trusted by thousands of leading brands around the world. You can start your free trial today at dotmailer.com/futurecommerce and be sure to use the offer code FUTURECOMMERCE for 20% off applicable DotMailer packages. Future Commerce is brought to you by Link. Link makes your customers' post-purchase experience something they love through breakthrough innovation in artificial intelligence. Be sure to stick around to the middle of the show for a special offer. You can visit Link online today at letslink.com/podcast. That's letslink.com/podcast.
Welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about cutting edge and next generation commerce. I'm Brian.
And I'm Philip.
Today we have Caleb Light, co-founder of Power Practical. Say hello, Caleb.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, super excited to have you. And as always, we want you, our listener, to give us feedback about today's show. So please leave us some feedback in the discuss comment box on our site or on LinkedIn or Twitter or wherever else you can find us. You can always subscribe to listen to Future Commerce on iTunes and Google Play, or even listen right from your Amazon Echo on TuneIn Radio with the phrase, Alexa, play Future Commerce podcast. And with that, Caleb, I think, so we met back at the Amazon Pay Merchant Summit when you did a session there with Amazon Pay, and as kind of a part of a Mark Cuban company's panel, which is pretty exciting. But why don't you introduce yourself and kind of let people know who you are, what's your story, how did Power Practical come about, what do you guys sell? You've got some pretty cool stuff. So tell us about yourself.
Yeah, cool. Well, like you mentioned, my name's Caleb. I'm a Montana native living in Salt Lake City. That's where Power Practical is based out of. We've kind of started as a traditional outdoor company. Our first product that we brought to market in 2012 was the Power Pot, which was a camping cooking pot that when you put it on a fire or a stove and put water in it to heat it up, there was some technology in the bottom of it that would actually make power from that process of heating up the pot of water. So you could charge your USB devices kind of anywhere that you could make a fire and find some liquid to heat up.
So cool.
super innovative, really interesting product, got a lot of press. I mean, it was a good thing. So Power Practical, I mean, the long and the short, we came to be because of crowdfunding. I mean, that's like a major staple in how we develop products and how we bring products to market. And, you know, in the hard good business, starting a company, it's pretty cash intensive. And with a platform like crowdfunding, where you can spend relatively no money to kind of put a prototype and bring something to life and then take it to the people. And if it's good and you're buttoned up and you're ready, you can pre-sell it and collect the cash and then actually go build it, which is this really interesting vehicle that didn't exist 10 years ago. So
very, very true.
For those who aren't familiar, Caleb, you were on Shark Tank, were you not?
Yeah. So like I said, we launched the company in 2012 in April, roughly with a crowdfunding campaign for the Power Pot. And then pretty much a year later, we actually got an email from one of the producers of Shark Tank asking us to apply because they found our Kickstarter campaign for the Power Pot and they thought it was interesting and, you know, wanted us to apply to be on the show. And so we built up some docs, made a video, and in July of 2013, we were in LA filming.
That's awesome. Yeah. And one of the things, I will have to link it up in the show notes, but you go into depth about your Kickstarter experience on a podcast that I found called The Art of the Kickstart, which, you know, I feel like really gives a good retrospective of how successful that Kickstarter was. Do you feel like Kickstarter and crowdfunding in general is sort of reinvigorating makers and entrepreneurs to be able to bring products to market? Like you said, it's it is disruptive, but there's also a lot of competition in the space now. It's not just Kickstarter anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think irrelevant of the platform, the idea of crowdfunding has really enabled, you know, this massive maker movement. I mean, think of all the 3D printers that hit in, what was it, 2012, 2013 because of crowdfunding. Like, would that have worked in a brick and mortar distribution strategy? I don't know. I mean, there's so much involved in that sale in terms of assisting and helping someone understand. I don't know if that could have worked. Maybe it would have, because it's just such an interesting technology, but I don't know if it would have had the same adoption rate as something like crowdfunding, where all these like quote unquote early adopters, you know, can go and actually experience the what it is to bring something to life, assuming the creator is good about updates and other things like that.
Mm. Yeah. And then you went from crowdfunding to being funded by Mark Cuban as you eventually took a deal. Was there kind of anything kind of in between crowdfunding and Mark Cuban? And then how was it to go from sort of being self-made, going with this crowdfunding approach to having a more dedicated investor like Mark Cuban Companies?
Hmm. That's a good question.
Yeah. So, like I said, we did the crowdfunding campaign in April 2012, and in 30 days we raised, $126,000. And so we spent that whole summer building PowerPots in Salt Lake. Like, literally the team, me included, built everything that we sold, plus we built about double of what we sold. And wow. Then we actually set out locally to raise money with the whole strategy of crowdfunding products in the outdoor space and then taking them into the traditional outdoor brick and mortar distribution strategy, the REIs, the Cabela's, all the independent right. shops. And so we actually closed the round in January of 2013. And then we got invited to go on Shark Tank and ended up taking more money from Mark because of just all the upside of working with Cuban Companies and, you know, the marketing and everything else relative to Shark Tank. So we were actually in a pretty good spot before we went on Shark Tank relative to cash. I mean, we ended up needing it, and it was really good that we got it for a ton of reasons beyond the money. But it was, we kind of took a blended approach from these new kind of interesting vehicles for bringing products to life. And also kind of the traditional methods of raising money and hiring people and trying to like build something quicker than you could just bootstrapping.
Mm. Right. What do you think of, if you could outline just one or two things, and I don't want to catch you off guard here, but what do you think the difference is between building like a successful direct to consumer, play, what is the difference to that with, doing the sort of crowdfunding, pre-sale, fulfilling on, pre-orders type of approach? I see a lot more, of these smaller boutique brands today that are taking like a 100% crowdfunded model. There's a lot of luggage brands that seem to be going in that direction here today, at least those that constantly wind up in my in my social media advertising. At least they're buying a lot of social ad spend. Yeah. But what do you think about what's the difference between, building a direct consumer play versus the crowdfund?
Well, I think that some of the tactics are the same. Part of which we'll get into, further along in the conversation, but a lot of the tools that you have relative to selling on crowdfunding, video, text, imagery, as pretty much as you want to put on the page, you have those similar set of tools with a direct-to-consumer play that you don't necessarily have in retail distribution. So I think the tools are similar. I think that the customer demographic is probably pretty different. There's only a certain amount of people that I would put in the early adopter bucket that are willing to kind of go out on a limb and take a risk of pre-ordering something that hasn't been built and then waiting a long time to get it, potentially a lot longer than they anticipate, which is more frequent than not. Whereas with a direct-to-consumer model, you're tapping into a consumer that may not have that same ambition in terms of or same willingness to wait and take a risk, where they want kind of that instant gratification. So I think honestly, you kind of have to have a at least the way we think about it, is a little of both to try to capture kind of different types of consumers.
Interesting. Hey, Brian, that's one thing you never hear in people talking about their omni-channel strategy.
Yeah.
is building a successful, crowdfunded or pre-order, pre-sales initiative. One thing I always find really interesting, and I know we're way off script here, but I'm just kind of fascinated. One thing I find interesting is the use of video and the use of displaying sort of prototypes and sort of showing the creative process and what goes into the making of the product plays a much bigger role. Like the story of the creation of the product plays a much bigger role in the crowdfunding space than it does in the direct consumer space. And I find that interesting that we don't see more of that sort of storytelling and that engaged storytelling where people are spending, lots of time and effort watching videos of these stories of product being created and sort of the aspirations of the business and what they're, sort of planning on, what their trajectory is. I see that a lot in the Kickstarter model. And I feel like that would be very, very beneficial if, businesses, potentially those merchants that are listening to the show right now, would adopt some of those types of strategies as well. It seems like a missed opportunity.
It's a good point.
I'm torn. If you don't mind me just being totally blunt and honest with you.
Please. Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people think that people care about who they are and what they stand for and kind of what their process was. And they really like talking about it and showing it off. And there probably is a certain amount of people that do care about that. I am a chronic Kickstarter backer. I've probably backed 50 campaigns. I'm not as bad as some, or as good as some, probably for Kickstarter, right? But it's like there's two reasons why I personally back a crowdfunding campaign. One is I have a personal relationship with the person or company that's doing it, and I want them to succeed, so I'll support them. And then the second is I think whatever they're making is really awesome, and that's why I'm buying, right? And I'm willing to like take the risk of maybe I don't get it and maybe it's going to take a year longer or 2 years longer than anticipated. And that's okay because I probably don't really need it, but it's cool. And so that's kind of the theory that we subscribe to. And when we make videos and we produce the content, it's not like there's a little bit about that because it's kind of part of the culture of crowdfunding and kind of what you see everywhere. And to your point, there probably is some people that are really into it. But when we make videos and when we create the content, it's really use case based where we're trying really hard to get someone to relate with at least one of those use cases. And if we do that, then we think we can capture them. And with one of our campaigns, we spent no money for advertising. We raised like 300 and almost 400 grand. And we had a 10% conversion rate on that campaign, according to Google Analytics.
Wow.
Which is insane, right?
Yeah, like, that's amazing.
Yeah, if you can find a way to reproduce that, you could just sell that strategy. Forget the products.
Right? So I mean, there definitely is that component. If you look at crowdfunding in general, like that, there's definitely that massive component. But I will say it kills me when I watch a crowdfunding video and there's some dude or lady or whoever, the business owner, the creator, sitting in front of camera talking about themselves and what they went through to like think of their product. It's not like really selling the product, right? That's they're like selling something else and it's not the product.
I get that. Yeah, it's interesting because I do think that there's a fine line. One of the things that, Brian and I are sort of in the consulting systems integrator realm. And one of the things we see a lot of, and one of the hallmarks of sort of an immature business is one that's completely obsessed with telling their story. Like every part of the customer journey has to inform you of who we are and where we came from. And I think that it is important to some degree. I do think that if you can find a way for your product to be experiential without spending the time on editing video and creating, this multimedia experience and all the, garbage that comes along with that, you should do that. You should do anything that you can to avoid having to make a very expensive and time-consuming video. There's just some products I don't know that you can, that you get that experience. I look at some of the, again, coming back to luggage or bags or something to that effect. you know, the actual experience of seeing the bag open and seeing, you know, it being used and how much can you pack in it. And that's a particular part of that niche industry that I think was very tough to convey with picture alone. But I do think that there's likely some other application. There's some lessons to be learned.
Yeah, I think so. I think that your main point is, and obviously execution is paramount, but is that
sure.
With a Kickstarter, it seems like, you know, a lot of them require or like the way that they sell is by sort of telling, you know, at minimum a product story. Whereas a lot of retailers that get started or brands that get started just you know, down the e-commerce line without going through a Kickstarter, oftentimes skip that step and end up without content and have a much more difficult time going back and actually building out that content down the road. And I think definitely a benefit of kind of going the route that you went, Caleb, is that, you know, you definitely got some amazing content. And you know, you guys prioritized it, which is to your credit. And I think you're reaping the benefits. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not trying to downplay the need of telling a good story with video and telling a good story about features and benefits and how it came to be relative to what lives on the page, both in text and imagery. That's like an insanely important aspect of being successful on the platform. It's just, you know, trying to keep in the back of your mind, if anyone's out there listening, well, there definitely is people out there listening, but are thinking about doing a crowdfunding campaign, to have that focus on like, what is the core message of this product? Who are you trying to sell it to and why are they going to be interested? And that's what you should focus on in terms of your storytelling, right?
Yeah. Yep.
That's so true. So.
Yeah, that's true for everybody.
Exactly. Yeah, not just crowdfunded. It's all retailers and brands should be following that strategy.
And one other kind of interesting point. Sorry to interrupt you guys, but like the people that do crowdfunding, that purchase crowdfunding products, it's this really interesting group of people that are trained to spend a bunch of time and consume a bunch of content. If you can create something compelling that hooks them and get them to your page, whether that be like you're spending money to drive those eyeballs, or you know, you're getting some organic love from whatever it may be, press, whatever. But like they spend a ton of time on the page and they consume a bunch of content on your page. And if you can get them and you supply them a good product and they have a great experience, it's insane like how vocal they are, both in a negative and positive way. I mean, that campaign I was telling you about, that we did almost 400K and had a 10% conversion rate. We had over 6,000 customers. And we did a survey after about a month. They got the product about a month later. We did a survey and we had 2,200 responses to the survey.
Wow.
I mean, it's like 20 questions, you know what I mean? And
insanely engaged. Wow.
Yeah, right? It blew my mind. And we had like, what are the top five things that you'd want to change? And we took those top five things and dumped it into a new product and launched it and did more money on the next crowdfunding campaign than we did on that one. So we, in essence, crowdsourced innovation from a purchasing kind of customer base, which is like turns the table on a lot relative to what commerce has been to that point, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, and to your point, I think it's interesting because that's ultimately what every company should be doing, is trying to learn about its product and the experience of its customers. You have a very engaged audience, it seems, in a particular area of product, but I think like that should just be table stakes. That's every retailer should be doing that, no matter what product you make or sell. And that's sort of a shame. I have to wonder though, at some point, you know, when does Kickstarter or Indiegogo or whoever it is, when do they get wise to this and they say, you know what, we're not capitalizing on is the Netflix model of, you know, people watch Westerns and cowboy movies and they watch superheroes. Why don't we make superhero cowboys? And at some point, somebody's going to get smart and say, well, people like coolers and they like blenders and they like luggage. Let's make, you know, let's mash them all up and get a company to make those products. And I think that, you know, they'll turn to their own maker community to be the ones to fulfill on, you know, the data that they're gathering. Anyway.
Yeah.
Brian, I'm sorry. I feel like you were about to say something.
Oh, no, no. I was just kind of running down a little bit of path, but I was kind of driving at, so the cool thing about Kickstarter and so on, and maybe why you have such an engaged audience is because they have become so invested in this. Like, they're waiting for their product. They're thinking about it. They considered it before they supported it. I think that might be another benefit of running with a crowdsourced approach. You're actually sort of, by virtue of being crowdsourced, sort of picking up a more engaged audience, a more engaged customer base. And so that's just another thing to think about as brands and retailers, you know, even maybe spin off new things like, or they're, you know, start new companies and so on. That there's opportunity to have a much more engaged user base through Kickstarter or through any crowdsource platform up front. So you kind of talked a little bit about your product strategy, you know, and your kind of initial go to market. And it, you know, obviously the crowdfunding was the first step. And then you briefly mentioned kind of going out and talking to REI and other retailers out there and going to there. And you also mentioned going to market with another product after getting feedback. So clearly, you know, as you developed, you sort of started to change your go-to-market strategy. Was it just building upon what you initially did, or was it a full-on shift? Did you have sort of a pivot moment?
Yeah, we definitely had a pivot moment. So we've actually done 8 Kickstarter campaigns, and I don't know, I've acquired 50,000 customers on that platform or something between those 8 campaigns. And like I mentioned, when we raised money, the whole premise of why we raised money was to crowdfund products and then take them into traditional brick and mortar distribution. And I closed REI, Cabela's, Academy, major retailers in Canada, Europe, Sam's Club, Brookstone, Staples. I mean, I got product into a lot of places. We opened up a lot of doors. But what we learned really quickly was that selling in is the easy part, and selling through is this whole other massive problem that requires a bunch of thought before you go into that distribution strategy. And it was actually killing us. We were really close to dying. And in January of 2016, we killed off all of our brick and mortar distribution and focused exclusively on Amazon and powerpractical.com. And we have a handful of international distribution partners that we still work with. But it's relatively small piece of our business. And like, the only reason we're still alive and in business is because of that pivot. Like, I literally would not be where I am right now if we wouldn't have done that. So
that's definitely a pretty bold statement. I mean, or not your statement, but like what happens to this small merchant community. I think there's been a lot of talk about brick and mortar dying, and I think for smaller brands entering the market or new brands, this is definitely a kind of a wake up call. Digital is where people are, and it's going to, you know, when you're just getting started, it's going to, I don't want to say be easier, but perhaps a little bit more natural to start, you know, maybe go with a digital only strategy instead of trying to go work with these brick and mortar retailers. It's definitely a really interesting story that you have. Now you're selling a lot of your product through Amazon, you know, and I think you're a pretty big proponent of Amazon based on what I heard you say at the Amazon Merchant Summit, Amazon Pay Merchant Summit. But how did the experience of engaging with Amazon sort of start for you? Like, you had this big pivot. What did it look like for you to really stray away from these big brick and mortar retailers, and what steps did you have to take to get to really wean yourself from them and put all of your chips into the digital channel?
That is a loaded question.
It's a little bit, yeah.
There's a lot of meat behind that one. We had like a board meeting in the fall of 2015, and there was like a couple outcomes that we decided we would try. And one of them was like close the doors. One of them was like sell the company. And one of them was like downsize and try the online approach. And so we set out to like sell the company. And it was right during CES, an outdoor retailer show. And the gentleman from Mark Cuban Companies that does business development introduced me to the Amazon exclusives team and thought we should try it. We had nothing to lose, really. But what happened was we had this really interesting product called the Loom Noodle that we crowdfunded. And we had a lot of interest from a bunch of retailers that wanted to buy it. And we just told them, no, we're not going to sell it to you guys. We're going to try this other thing. And in the first month on Amazon in January of 2016, we did 6,000 bucks. And we're just like, oh man, I don't know if this is going to And then we like tripled that. And then, you know, by June, we were in six figures monthly. And so the ramp was really awesome. And the power of Amazon and the amount of traffic they get and the intent to buy of their customers is just insane. And one point that I want to make on kind of for the small brands or people looking to get started with hard goods or consumer goods is that there's this perception out there that, you know, if you make it to Walmart, you've made it. Like you can, you know, go buy your boat sort of thing. And that's not the case. Like you pay those guys because that's what you're doing to live on their shelf. And then you pay to get people into their store to buy your product because guess what? Like none of those retailers care about you because you're the small guy. You're not like paying bills. Yep. And so with that in mind, I would seriously advocate to not go down that path and take the direct approach because you have so many more levers that you can control and you can get real insight and you can acquire real customers that you, then you can remarket or upsell or cross-sell or do these all these other interesting things that you can't do in a traditional kind of distribution strategy. It's not as sexy. Like there's definitely not that appeal like there is because of whatever perception that's been created, which is total BS. But it's definitely the approach you should take because it's just going to be, you're going to have so much more control over your business and understanding of what's actually moving the needle.
Future Commerce is brought to you by Dotmailer. Dotmailer is used by thousands of marketers around the world. It has quick and easy campaign creation with a world-class intuitive interface. The Dotmailer team is always on hand from email creation, creative, and delivery to dedicated consultancy helping you build your own success story. Dotmailer is built to play well with others. You can build your own marketing cloud by extending Dotmailer or integrating it with your existing e-commerce and business platforms. Become a smarter, faster, better marketer and create sophisticated and measurable campaigns with Dotmailer. Go to dotmailer.com/futurecommerce to start your free trial today and be sure to use the offer code FUTURECOMMERCE for 20% off Dotmailer packages. Thanks again to Dotmailer for supporting Future Commerce. Link is the best way to get your customers coming back to buy again. Link's Cortex AI platform creates rich relationships with every customer at every touch point on every platform. From Magento to Shopify, Hybris and Demandware, over 300 logistic and reverse logistic carriers around the world are integrated with Link. Link brings your brand to where customers are on Facebook Messenger, Alexa, SMS, and more. Let Link add the power of artificial intelligence to your business. For a limited time, Future Commerce listeners can claim an exclusive trial offer for 30 days free of Link Cortex. Sign up today and visit them online at letslink.com/podcast. That's letslink.com/podcast. So your advice is, if you can possibly get away with it, you know, the direct-to-consumer approach has a lot more upside and you have a lot more control. And if you're spending money to drive customers and traffic to someone else anyway, you might as well spend that money and that effort to learn something about your customers, drive them to your store, and capture that customer for yourself.
Yeah, well, and you know, if the brick-and-mortar distribution strategy is something that someone really wants to do eventually anyway, it's just you have that much more leverage in the conversation when you have traction than when you don't have traction, right? That's just that black and white. So if you could spend the time and learn how to do it yourself, then you have actually like, you have something to, when you go to the table, where you just don't get pushed around and bullied and merchandise wherever, like not bullied and like it's not in a traditional, like they're being mean, but in the sense of like, you don't have any control. Like you have so few levers because you're just so small, you're unproven. But if you go in there and it's like, look at what I'm doing on Amazon, guess what? They're like, oh my gosh, they start frothing and thinking about how much money they can make and what they can do to like try to replicate that because you have a baseline.
Mm. Right.
So do you consider selling through Amazon direct to consumer?
It's pretty close. It's not purely direct to consumer because you don't capture, like Amazon's very protective of their customers.
Right.
But there is still a lot of information you can get. And there's various things that you can do with that can help you as a business owner understand who they are and some of how they operate and touch them.
Nice. Yeah. You mentioned Amazon exclusives. Maybe just kind of for our listeners, could you kind of dive into a little bit more what that means for you as a brand and, you know, what the benefits are?
Yeah. So if you haven't heard of Amazon exclusives, like I love those guys. They've amazing team. They've turned our business around, like helped us turn our business around. So the Amazon exclusive program, what that means is you're committing to sell exclusively on Amazon and any storefronts that you own, which could be digital or brick and mortar, in the United States. You pay an additional 5% commission. It just ran through their marketplace. So you own the inventory. What you get out of it is a team at Amazon that you can talk to and consult with. They do like some remarketing on your behalf. They do a bunch of other marketing emails, et cetera. And then the other interesting thing about it is if, you know, you're good at that kind of business 101 relationship building, and you form relationships with humans over there, there's what I've been learning over the last, you know, year and a half is that there's all these really interesting programs that these kind of siloed teams are working on to do various things. And one of the, like the guinea pig for these new programs is Amazon exclusives. And as a result of the relationships I've built with that team, like I'm one of the first brands that gets to test or touch any of those new programs or betas, nice. Whatever it may be at Amazon, which is really interesting. Some of them are like, nah. And other ones are like, whoa, that was insane. You know? So that's definitely a massive upside. And I mean, if anyone's familiar selling on Amazon and if you have any issues, like it's really hard to actually talk to someone. And so by having kind of those personal relationships, it just really helps on kind of all sorts of levels. And then Amazon as an entity is just massive. I mean, there's like a lending department and video and like there's every kind of team you can imagine. And, you know, once you get inside the beast, you can start kind of navigating it and meeting all these different people and learning how kind of you can work with them to kind of amplify your business and accomplish kind of the goals you set out to accomplish.
Wow, that's amazing. I think that's a unique view on Amazon. I think that it's probably pretty encouraging for a lot of brands out there that are getting started. Amazon has been kind of intimidating for a lot of people. And so I think, you know, a lot of people are afraid that, you know, if they rely heavily on Amazon, that if they, you know, if Amazon does something different to their business practices, you know, it may change the way that, you know, they're competing and get to a point where, you know, they're not actually able to be in the market the way that they were before. Like, for instance, recently Amazon, is going to have a new refunds policy, which, I read an article on CNBC and it said that basically it will crush small businesses, outrage sellers say. obviously some of that's, you know, bravado, but, you know, are you nervous about Amazon making changes that are going to adversely affect your business or steal your business eventually? And you know, what words do you have to small retailers out there about that now that you're so engaged with Amazon?
Yeah. So that article that came out, that change actually is just relative to merchant fulfilled orders for. So it's like not shipping from Amazon, it's shipping from someone's warehouse, like garage or something, which.
Right. It was just the example.
Just so that people know, because Amazon's not necessarily trying to crush small businesses.
No, it's not. I know that.
I totally get what you're saying though. Like I read the whole, totally on the same page. So interesting enough, which Brian, you may have seen this at the Amazon Pay conference. There's actually, it was like $110 billion was driven through the merchant side, meaning people that aren't Amazon selling on the Amazon platform. And $90 billion, I think in 2016, was driven from the vendor side, which is like people selling to a buyer Amazon and then Amazon reselling their product. So and then other conferences I've been to, Amazon feels pretty strongly that, you know, in the next 4 to 5 years, whatever, 4 to 10 years, 5 to 10 years, that brands will actually be built on Amazon and not in traditional brick and mortar distribution channels. Yeah. So with that in mind, they're actually doing a lot now to try to help small businesses and brands kind of develop on their platform. And I've even heard that, you know, they're starting like, when Amazon talks about a customer, they like bend over backwards to make sure that customer is happy. And traditionally a customer has just been someone that buys something on the platform. And now they're starting to look at kind of the brands and the small businesses and the people that are coming, you know, bringing these new innovative products to life as a customer of Amazon, because it helps, you know, it's kind of a you know, multiple customers. And so I think they're doing a lot. I'm starting to see some of it too. Kind of help people like me or brands like mine kind of be built and come to life on their platform. They see a lot of value in that.
That's really exciting. Like essentially what you're saying is it's pretty much the opposite. Amazon's actually investing in small businesses. It's maybe sort of mid-size or large retailers that are competing with Amazon that should be nervous. Not so much majority of even sort of like mid-sized brands that are out there that are selling through Amazon. In fact, Amazon's doing everything they can to support those brands in those sales.
It's interesting because we have so many, our audience is an incredibly engaged, merchant sort of, and, you know, tangentially merchant focused or merchant related audience. And I think there's got to be some people out there who maybe saw things the way Caleb sees things right now, but, you know, maybe they were selling batteries or USB cables 5-7 years ago on Amazon and making a killing. And now, you know, Amazon Basics is putting them out of business. Maybe they're thinking to themselves, like, you know, enjoy it while it lasts, because eventually Amazon, you know, will come after you. That's the prevailing mindset between, you know, it depends on who you ask, but there's a good portion of people who do still see Amazon as the enemy. I think my caution to them is don't let your prior experience dictate, you know, your view of history now, because, you know, Amazon has to be part of your omnichannel strategy. It has to be. Let me finish the thought. Sorry. So it has to be. I think it's a more mature outlook to see Amazon as your partner than as the enemy, unless you're literally trying to compete with them and, you know, build a cloud service and all the other. So the point I would make is that, you know, Caleb has firsthand experience as an actual merchant. And I actually, come to think of it, I don't know that we've had directly a merchant on the show before. Which is, you know, saying a lot. So yes, sorry, go ahead. Nope. Both of you wanted to chime in.
We have had some merchants on the show, just not one that's selling on Amazon like Caleb is. But I think the other thing that, just to augment what you're saying, really, I think the other thing that I would say is be innovative with your brand. I think Caleb is doing really well because his product is actually really unique and cool. And I think, you know, mm-hmm. It's going to be a long time before Amazon starts commoditizing power pots.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There you go. It's probably true.
Go ahead, Caleb.
Sorry. No, if you want to finish your thought, sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Philip actually brings up an interesting point. And so if you think about someone that was selling cables or battery packs that is no longer selling cables or battery packs because of Amazon Basics, they most likely were doing a private label game where they weren't focused on building a brand. They were focused on serving a need that existed at the time. And I think that Amazon is actually trying to phase those guys out, because not that it isn't a good business or not that like there isn't a bunch of people that sell really quality stuff, but they're not trying to build a brand, right? It's a different kind of business model. You have like retail arbitrage, you know, buying and reselling stuff. You have private label where there's a defined category and you just go find the supplier and you put a different label on it, but you're not really trying to build a brand and you're just selling. And then you have like someone that's actually trying to build a brand, aggregate an audience, a customer base, bring more products to life that may or may not be in the same category. So I think as you like kind of look at those different business models, I could totally understand how someone in the retail arbitrage or private label feels really threatened, because Amazon is kind of cracking down on that and trying to, I think, kind of kill off that business, so to speak, and focus more on kind of the brand building.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I think brands are almost always going to be innovative. That's the other thing. If you're building a brand, you're either doing something special with customer service or with your product. And so, you know, people go and buy your product, they're going to have a special experience with it. If they're not, then it's something that can be commoditized. Then perhaps you shouldn't be in the market. So, I mean, if you're worried about having to, you know, build something special, then yeah, I wouldn't go get on Amazon.
Yeah.
And yeah, unless, of course, you can figure out how to work Amazon's search system really well and you're good at that thing.
Yeah. I find it really interesting. It's like, how many versions of a Chino do we really need in life? And Amazon decided one. You really only need, you know, their new clothing brand. Was it Good Threads or what is the,
Basics,
I forget the name
or
of
no.
it.
Base.
No. Yeah. Anyway, at some point, yes. You know, a pair of khakis is a pair of khakis. What makes yours, you know, special? But I do think that there's some, so there is some truth to that, and maybe fish oil too. But my, the larger point that I'm kind of making is that, you know, there people like Caleb are actually not so common, and products like what he sells are also not so common, and so yeah, you know, Amazon needs to invest in making those people successful. But I would also suggest that you know, and this is my own personal feeling, is that they just don't come around all that often. So it's part of a broader strategy that Amazon would definitely be investing in. But I have to wonder what the, you know, how that applies to, you know, maybe some other listeners of ours who have other types of business. I wish I actually had, like a real solid train of thought around that, because it's kind of just formulating. We'll have to have Caleb back at some
definitely.
Point. when I've gathered my thoughts, but I'm actually really intrigued right now.
I mean, you don't like, we sell a ton of LED strip lights, like a ton of them, mm-hmm. you know, and how many people have sold strip lights for how long? A long time.
Sure.
So we've come up with kind of an interesting way to package it, interesting way to apply it, making it really super functional, super easy to use, taking something that has been historically DIY and finishing it so that an everyday person that isn't going to spend the time thinking about wiring or that any of that kind of DIY-ishness, we just like kind of close the loop, and it's been super productive. Right. And so you can find these things that aren't, you know, you're not taking a pot and making electricity necessarily with every product. And honestly, sometimes those super kind of innovative products don't sell that well. Or the market isn't as big as something like an LED strip light that you put on the back of your television, for example, right?
Right, right.
So even if you don't have necessarily like these super heavy tech products, you can still think of ways of kind of bundling it or packaging it so that you make a clean experience so that someone wants to come back to your brand to buy whatever is new, right?
So that actually leads me to a really great sort of practical thing, which is, you know, how do you identify a Power Practical? How do you identify the products that are, you know, are winners? And how do you double down on those types of products and strategies so that you can replicate the success?
Yeah. So we actually take I think it's a pretty innovative approach to it. But what we do is we look for a product that we can, we call it a halo product or a land product that we can crowdfund. And the idea with that is it's something that's interesting that maybe doesn't exist, that hasn't existed, that we can kind of build a platform around. And then what we do is we crowdfund it. We acquire a bunch of these early adopter customers, very vocal. We seed it to them through the crowdfunding campaign. And then when we go to Amazon and go live, we go back to those people and ask them to help us kind of jumpstart it through the form of reviews and through these other kind of vehicles. And then while this is happening with the new supply chain potentially that we opened up through the crowdfunding campaign, we have a number of SKU expansions that we can leverage from the same manufacturing partner that we can take directly to Amazon. And when we take those products directly to Amazon, we go back to the crowd that kind of brought that whole line to life to like introduce it to them and have them kind of jumpstart it on the platform. And it's been this really insanely productive vehicle for kind of landing and expanding our product lines. And the thing is when you, when you take a product to Amazon, obviously you have like MOQs and some other kind of variables relative to manufacturing, but you don't have to go out and order a container. Order 100 units if you can,
right?
And put it online and watch what happens. You don't have to make these massive bets. It's not like a 1,000-door chain where you got to have, you know, 10 SKUs for each store and you got to make 10,000 of them and you got to pony up the cash to make it. And you're not going to get paid for like 6 months because of the manufacturing lead time and the shipping. And then it makes it there and then they have their payment terms. You know, there's not this insanely long cash cycle to recoup your cash with a channel like Amazon.
So find a product or a similar area or a vertical that tests your theory and does some market test and market acceptance testing, and use that in a small way to do sort of small limited runs, low capital investment tests of, you know, product theory. It's a great method of product testing.
Yeah. And then there's like a ton of other stuff you can do relative to Amazon they can't do in a traditional brick and mortar distribution strategy, like price elasticity testing. You know how hard it is to get those guys to change the price once it hits the store? It's like nearly impossible. Whereas on Amazon, it's like two button clicks and boom, you've changed the price. And then you can watch it for a few days and see if it goes up or down. You know, I mean, it's pretty incredible.
That in combination, and you mentioned with exclusives, you could actually have your own site as well, along with a brick and mortar if you wanted your own brick and mortar, I think you said. It's a pretty nice compliment to have a Shopify site like you have. How has the experience been sort of having your own site and integrating it with Amazon and managing both your own site and managing on Amazon? And if you don't mind me asking, how significant a portion of your business is direct on your site versus on Amazon?
So currently on our site's relatively small compared to Amazon, because we've just invested a whole lot more time into building our Amazon channel. But we're in full blown build the direct channel now. And I'm hoping by the end of the year, it'll be close to 50-50. That's the goal. There's a bunch of good things about having your own site. And what we've been focusing on most recently is thinking about, you know, what kind of bundles or offers can we create that increases the average order value, but is hyper-focused on a specific kind of target customer? Because we can go to a channel like Facebook and kind of narrow down who that kind of really hyper-focused customer would be. And we can serve ads to them and drive them to a specific landing page that's custom tailored with specific content that's hyper-focused with a specific offer that's hyper-focused. And by kind of taking this really, you know, just started to use hyper-focus so much, but it's just so important.
Yeah.
From ad to landing page to offer, you know, you just increase the likelihood that, you know, those ad dollars are going to be productive.
Merchants, listen up. This is really good advice.
Yeah, you're getting a masterclass right now. My other thought was, you know, and this is sort of the hardest thing that we do today in our world is really trying to make an art of channel attribution. You know, I find myself responding and buying on Amazon as a result of seeing a social ad that drives to the direct consumer site. It's just more convenient for me to purchase through Amazon. And I feel like I've got some legitimacy in the brand if they are on Amazon. Not that I don't trust the brand, but you know, I can click once and get it on Amazon after searching for your brand name. And that's that element of convenience is tremendous.
Day so, free shipping.
You know, that social. Yeah. And yeah, well, exactly. But the, you know, the hope is like, I don't even mind if I have to, you know, if you're shipping the product and it's not necessarily FBA, like, or whatever, however it's fulfilled, I don't even really mind if it's 2-day shipping or longer. It's for me, it's more about the sort of, you know, there's some credibility. If you're selling on Amazon, I trust you, because I trust Amazon.
Yeah.
I wonder if I'm alone. I'm probably an odd consumer.
No, I don't think you're alone. I feel the same way. Buying on Amazon gives me so much more trust in a brand than, say, buying a brand on any other platform. Whether
yeah, you know that.
Go ahead.
You know that they have like the A to Z return guarantee, and like there's all these kind of risk mitigators relative to Amazon. And the bottom line that merchants, if you're not selling on Amazon, this is the most important thing you need to hit listen to hear, is that when someone goes to Amazon, there's an intent to buy. Very, very rarely does someone go to Amazon to do product research to figure out what they want to buy or what kind of options there are in a category. They have an intent to buy something, and they generally do.
It's true. Hmm. It's true. Yeah, if you're researching, you're usually going elsewhere. I have researched products on Amazon, but again, I'm not necessarily the the model customer. Let me ask you, Prime Day. We were trying to get you on the show on Prime Day. Obviously, that was a really bad time to get you on. How has Prime Day affect your business? I mean, since you're really focused on Amazon, do you have any advice for merchants engaging in Prime Day, and you know what? How do you see it affecting the market in general?
So last year was the first time we did Prime Day. Like last year, we did we broke six figures in one day, and the month before we broke six figures in the whole month. Wow. And the month before that, we did you know half of that. So it just like it honestly blew my mind. I had no clue what that was going to be like. And then this year we did more than we did on Prime Day in the whole month of July, on one day. So it's this amazing time where, you know, obviously you got to look at the numbers and make sure you can make things work, but like you should totally take advantage of it. It's a great time to like get your product in the hands of tons and tons and tons of people, because there's a lot of people coming to the site. It's a massive day of traffic for Amazon. And it's ripe for the picking. I mean, one of our deals was like trending on Prime Day. So,
wow.
It's insane.
It really has affected shopping. Philip and I've talked about it a little bit in the past, but never with a merchant. And it's really interesting to hear your experience with it. I think it's sort of lifted up the entire retail industry, not just on Amazon, but across other retailers and channels as well. As people go to shop online, you know, other retailers have on Amazon. Amazon's had enough sway to actually pull other retailers into the fray and introduce their own, you know, pricing discounts and so on. So, we actually need to wrap it up here.
Can I make one more comment relative to Prime Day? Sorry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So the one interesting thing, which I'm happy to tell you guys after Q4 this year, but what we did in July, we pretty much replicated in November and December. It was, for me, which I'll test this theory, an indicator of what I should expect for Q4 in November and December. Like literally July was the same as November, and then July was the same as December, which is really helpful when you think through inventory planning and cash requirements for all that sort of stuff. And so, like I said, I'm going to see if it holds true this year, but it was cool. It was nice for me because I have to plan inventory and figure out what we need to buy and how many. So it's just kind of a marker of what to expect in Q4.
Interesting. That's a really good, more good advice, more good insight. Thank you so much, Caleb. Just to kind of a final note, this is something we kind of ask all of our guests. What's a strategy you see that like your top strategy that you see that will help retailers thrive in the next year? And then maybe a little further out, what do you see coming ahead in the next 3 to 5 years?
So if you're not considering crowdfunding, it's an amazing vehicle to help bring products alive. You get validation. If it comes alive, you get an insanely good customer base that you can tap into at a whole plethora of levels that we can't talk about in one podcast. And where I see it going in the future is I think that crowdfunding is going to evolve. And I think there's a high likelihood that it's going to take on it somehow the everything with the cryptocurrency and the blockchain. I think that there's some interesting plays relative to the blockchain technology and crowdfunding as it lines up against different milestones for actually bringing a product to life. I think there's some really interesting kind of applications in that. And I think we'll see that kind of come to life over the next, maybe in a year, maybe 3 years. I don't know. I think it's going to happen though relatively soon.
That's awesome. Good place to wrap, although I've been saving this for a while now. This all makes me feel like Amazon at some point is going to introduce a crowdfunding option as part of their services they offer. And I'm definitely looking forward to see if that happens. So small prediction there at the end. But thank you guys, or thank you, Caleb, so much. And thank you, Philip, as always. It was really great to hear your insight. It really, you've been through a lot for a retailer as young as you are. And I really love how you've responded and been able to come out on the other side really successful. It's awesome to see. And I really enjoy talking with you.
Well, thanks for letting me come on and chat with you guys for a few minutes. Hopefully it's productive for your audience.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much. Congratulations on all your success. And if you want to check out these products, you can go to powerpractical.com and make sure to check out some of their great and innovative products. We also want to make sure that you check us out. We want to remind you that we have our Future Commerce Insiders newsletter that just launched and our first one just went out. Really excited to have, full unedited interviews, behind the scenes discussion, news, rumors, exclusive content, all that good stuff. And you can get that exclusively on futurecommerce.fm. Make sure you like and subscribe. At any rate, that wraps up another episode, right, Brian?
Oh, yes. With that, keep looking towards the future.